Hello and welcome to Obsession, where we get horribly obsessed, highly obsessed, hilariously obsessed with things that other people might find odd. Nothing is too obscure, too creepy, or too weird for us to research obsessively. I'm Heidi.
And I'm Rebecca.
Join us in being obsessed.
Hello, Heidi. Hello, obsessives. How
are you? Hi, Rookie. Hi, obsessives. How are you?
Heidi, what have you been obsessing over these past few weeks?
Well, I can't stop reading stories about orcas.
Oh,
you know how the orcas are just going wild and the rudders of these luxury yachts?
Yep. Yep. We're so team orca, aren't we?
Yeah. Oh, I love them. I love them.
I read somewhere that apparently one of them was injured by a boat and he's sort of trained everybody else to attack them. But yeah. I'm kind of hoping it hit the entire sea. Well, maybe it has.
No.
Recent events.
Yeah. There are orcas near Scotland that are doing the same thing now.
Are you serious?
Yes. And they seem to be teaching each other. The mother orcas seem to be teaching the baby orcas how to do it.
That is so profoundly
It's
bad.
So good.
But
I
so
love
profoundly
it.
Cool. I really am team Mother Nature. They've got to fight back against us because we're horrible. We really are.
Totally. Totally. Yeah.
So I'm definitely on the side of the orcas. Good luck to them.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, I, for one, think they couldn't do a worse job than the billionaires who control us now. So, like, if they want to start a revolution.
Oh, yeah.
And if they want to be our slippery overlords. I'm going to welcome them right now.
Me too. Definitely me too.
And that was a bit of a segue. Did you notice?
What was the segue? No, well, I missed it.
Well, I was saying if they want to be our slippery overlords.
Oh, yes. Talking of, I was too busy laughing at the idea of an orca taking over. But yes, a slippery leader, huh?
Yeah.
Overlord.
Yeah.
Whatever could we be talking about tonight, Heidi?
Well, it's a cracking good story.
It is. Tonight, we are talking about dear or not so dear leaders today. We are talking about the magic of cinema as well.
North Korean cinema, to be precise, which is quite a niche area.
Very niche. And suddenly appeared all over my YouTube algorithm for some reason.
Yeah.
I am thinking there's not a lot of people who've considered that North Korea even has a film industry, let alone seen anything produced there. North Korea is known as the hermit country, after all, and they are notoriously secretive about what goes on there.
Well, there are a surprising amount of them in their entirety on YouTube. And as someone who's been watching North Korean movies over the past few weeks, I can tell you that they are pretty special.
Mm. So this episode is going to be about a specific incident in the history of North Korean film industry. And it's one of the most fascinating yet widely unknown stories that I've ever heard.
Well, years ago, I read a book called A Kim Jong-il Production by Paul Fisher. And I just recently saw it on my bookshelf and I couldn't believe I hadn't suggested this story as an episode before. It is the most amazing story. And I suppose it's good for our 30th episode.
30th episode. How cool are we?
I know.
And they reckon that Geminis can't stick to anything.
I know. Well, don't they look silly?
Well, I do think that 30 feels like a very significant number. I'm not sure most of our listeners out there at least are aware enough of North Korea to know that it is almost completely sealed off from the rest of the world and has been under the fierce and cruel dictatorship of the Kim family since 1948, starting with Kim Il-sung. This story tonight focuses on Kim Il-sung's son, Kim Jong-il and takes place in the years before he inherited his father's role of supreme leader.
Look, I suppose you could say the story truly began in 1942 when a magical bird sang a song about a glorious general, ruler of the world who would soon be born in the secret headquarters of the Korean Revolutionary Liberation Army.
I'm Heidi.
The great leader, Kim Il-sung, had the secret headquarters near the magnificent Mount Paktu, also known as the Sacred Mountain of the Revolution. Kim Il-sung's wife and former bodyguard gave birth to Kim Jong-il in a cabin in the mountains during a thunderstorm. At the moment of Jong-il's birth, the storm ceased and a double rainbow appeared across the sky and a bright new star was formed.
Not really. And
the
Heidi...
fighters of the Korean Revolutionary Liberation Army rejoiced, vowing to devote their lives to the liberation of the fatherland. Jong-il was a prodigy who could walk at 3 weeks old, talk at 8 weeks, and when the tiny Jong-il blotted a map of Japan with ink, natural disasters would happen in the exact parts where the ink splattered on the map. Incredible.
And completely untrue. And Heidi, I am going to take YouTube away from you.
Oh, come on. No. The story of our dear leader.
I mean, it's a nice, I mean, everyone likes to say that they were born in the middle of a thunderstorm, but they really, that family took it to the extreme.
Yeah.
Anyway, Jong-il created a pretty mythology for himself, but in reality, he was born on February the 16th, 1941, in a Soviet army camp in Russia. His birth name was Yuri Isolovich Kim. His father had been arrested by the Japanese for starting a Marxist-Leninist union. After his release, he joined the guerrillas in northeastern China in the fight for Korean independence, which started the string of events that led him to becoming the dear leader. Kim Jong-il was a dull, lazy, and entitled boy, and he had the streak of viciousness and cruelty that seems to be inherent in the men of the Kim dynasty. The one thing that seemed to spark his sluggish mind was cinema. Jong-il spent much of the teenage years and young adulthood in the Central Film Distribution Center, where he would sit in the darkness of his private cinema and binge watch movies. Soon enough, though, he exhausted the supply of films kept in the center, and he set up Resource Operation Number 100, his own Western film piracy operation. Embassies around the world were given the task of making copies of any and every film they could get their hands on. When the film reels arrived in Pyongyang, they were then translated by staff who were allowed to listen to, but not actually watch the movies. That's right, nobody in the country, be it the staff of the movie library, the translators, or the actors whose voices were recorded for dubbing, were allowed to watch these films. The entire operation was for Jong-il and Jong-il only. Cinema became his only interest and his only focus in life.
After college, Jong-il was expected to work for the party and understand all its intricacies, but all he wanted to do was to sit in the darkness of his cinema and watch James Bond, Rambo, and anything that starred Elizabeth Taylor. His movie collection had grown to around 15,000 reels, and he had become a cinema buff with extensive knowledge of the world outside of North Korea, but almost no interest in the running of his own country. Nobody expected very much of the leader's lazy, deadbeat son, until one day he put up his hand to take responsibility for the propaganda and agitation department.
How's that name? Anyway.
It's great. Everyone was taken aback, including his father. Then again, in many ways, it should have been expected that the propaganda and agitation department would be a good fit for Jong-il, as one of the main responsibilities was the production of entertainment for propaganda purposes, namely films. In 1968, when Jong-il took over the department, the citizens of North Korea were not enthusiastic about watching movies, and for good reason. They were only allowed movies and TV shows that were produced within the borders. And these were written and directed by men in the party, not by people with any interest or training in the creative arts. Everything they were given to watch was repetitive, unimaginative, and full of patriotic messages delivered as tedious monologues. Jong-il decided he was going to change all that. He would reinvent the local film industry so that it had all the thrill and swagger of Hollywood and deliver a gut punch of propaganda. He oversaw the renovation of the film studio and expanded its size to 10 million square feet. And he also brought in state-of-the-art technology. The directors and teams behind the new films were ordered to make their output more like Hollywood films, with only one problem. None of them were actually allowed to watch Hollywood films. This kind of reminds me of the episode we did on the Shags. You know, the father said, you know, you're not allowed to listen to pop music in this house, but you have to write pop songs. Yeah, incredible.
That is a good analogy.
Jong-il would spend hours describing the movies he wanted them to emulate in the hope that the crew could imagine what it was he wanted to see. The films that were made under the watchful supervision of Jong-il likely were better than their predecessors. It's almost impossible to find anything made before 1968, but most of what was produced by Jong-il was definitely not a threat to the international film industry. And ultimately, that's what Jong-il desperately wanted, for North Korean films to gain international acclaim and respect.
And there wasn't much chance of that happening. The films that were sent to international film festivals were generally considered quaint curiosities, interesting only because they were a glimpse into the hermit kingdom. In terms of filmmaking, they were a bit of a joke. In spite of Jong-il's extensive knowledge of current films, the movies he produced were wildly out of touch with the modern world. If you watch a North Korean movie from this time, and there are plenty on YouTube, trust me on this, they are almost eerily old-fashioned and portray the type of wholesome, innocent outlook that no one outside of an Enid Blyton book could find realistic. The patriotic messages were as subtle as a blow from a sledgehammer, and the actors would breathlessly deliver their lines while staring into the middle distance, a style of cinematic acting that was more 1930s than 1970s. The storylines generally centred around work, of course, and the protagonists, whether factory workers, office drones, or fruit pickers, would have an almost religious devotion to their workplace and the role that they played there. These movies are the hymns to the glory of being a cog in the great wheel that is the fatherland. Romantic storylines were relegated to the background or not seen at all. The real love story is between the protagonist and their great leader, Kim Il-sung, and the dramatic tension is in how they learn to overcome individualism and serve the ideals of their leader and their country.
And as you know, I've been watching a lot of movies from this time.
Yeah, thanks for the Apple one. Yeah,
yeah, and they're very interesting. They're like Valium.
Yes!
Yeah, like they're horribly boring, but they're soothing in a very weird way.
Yes.
Like that film I sent you about the Apple Picking Girl.
Yes.
oh, this lovely little world where they just they pick apples and they care about these apples so much. And
but by the end, we both cared about the apples too, Heidi.
I know, we did, we did.
The jam jars, Heidi.
Oh my gosh. The youth work leader needed to give them the jam jars so the apples wouldn't go to waste. Oh God, the tension. The dramatic tension.
It actually really alarmed me how much I enjoyed that movie.
I know.
But not that I enjoyed it, because, you know, we all have these bad movies that we just really enjoy because they're bad. Right. I actually felt good after watching the movie. I shouldn't say that.
I know, because it's this idealistic world where everyone is just so happy in their place in society and they don't want anything else.
And they have a unified goal.
Yes. And there's no rivalry. There are no mean bosses.
No.
Everyone is just nice to each other all
everyone
the time.
Happy and very, very enthusiastic about apples.
Oh, and I really don't think it reflected society at all.
Yeah, definitely not. So anyway, back to the story. In 1972, there was some international success when The Flower Girl won an award at a film festival in what was then Czechoslovakia. And this was the film that seemed to be a hit with the local audiences as well. It's hard to say what North Koreans thought about the films at this time because there are no standard box office records, of course. It was mandatory to see these films, whether you enjoyed them or not. Not only did people have to sit through public viewings, they had to hang around afterwards and participate in a criticism session and prove to officials that they had ingested the messages. However, people seem to have genuinely loved The Flower Girl and enjoyed the communal weeping that was brought on by the story of a poverty-stricken flower seller and her family who were indentured servants to a cruel Japanese masters in 1930s Korea. Jong Il wrote a book called On the Art of the Cinema, and all of his directors were instructed to read it. So Jong Il had a captive audience for these productions, but he still wasn't happy. What really stuck in his craw was that South Korea was starting to gain international recognition as a filmmaking nation, and they were getting the acclaim that he wanted for the industry in the North. He became fixated on the major players in the South Korean world, two in particular. Their names were Shin Sang-ok and Choi In-hee.
Shin Sang-ok was one of the most beloved and successful film directors in South Korea. He was a risk taker, a maverick, and a boundary pusher. These things weren't appreciated by everyone. The South Korean film industry was regulated very tightly, and Shin did whatever he could to find loopholes and wriggle around the laws. He became friends with President Park Chung-hee, using this friendship to get him out of trouble and to make himself an exception to the rules. Shin could be headstrong and arrogant, and he rebelled furiously against any regulation that did not allow him to have total creative control over every aspect of his films. He was married to Choi Yong-hee, the Meryl Streep of South Korea, and they were a magnificent and loved celebrity power couple. That is, until Shin was discovered to have fathered a son with a young actress. Unable to regain her trust in her husband, Choi decided on a separation.
And fair enough.
Yes. This was devastating to Shin, who, despite his affairs, adored his wife and knew that he could never find another creative partner with her level of talent. He should have thought of that. Never good with business or money, Shin's production company began to sink and his creative output lost its spark. President Park, who could not be seen to have a disgraced adulterer such as Shin as his friend, cut ties with him. The final blow came with the release of Shin's film, Rose and Wild Dog, which featured a 3-second kiss. This shockingly long kiss went against censorship rules, and without President Park to come to his rescue, Shin lost his production license and was no longer allowed to make films. His wife, Choi Yun-hee, was also going through a rough time. She still loved Shin, and the news that his mistress was pregnant with their second child made her realize that divorce was the only option. Having mainly retired from acting, Choi occupied herself with raising her adopted children and teaching performing arts at the academy that she and Shin still ran together. It was in 1977 that a severely depressed Choi had a meeting with a man who claimed to be a film studio boss in Hong Kong. His name was Wang Dong-il, and he wanted to employ Choi's talents as an acting coach for his performing arts academy. Nothing came of the plan, but at some point he came back with another proposition for Choi to come to Hong Kong to direct a film.
Now, it would be weird for a Hong Kong studio to need a director from South Korea. They had plenty of their own. But Choi had something to prove. She'd spent decades being one of the most respected actresses in her country. Why not try her hand at directing? She knew her stuff. So she took a flight and met Wang in Hong Kong. She found, much to her annoyance, that Wang was not interested in talking about the film and seemed only want to be her tour guide. At some point, Choi met up with a woman called Mrs. Lee, who claimed to be an old friend of Shin's. Choi spent time with Mrs. Lee and her little girl while Wang was looking after unexpected business issues. One day, Mrs. Lee announced that she had an acquaintance who could be a useful financial contact for Choi and Shin's acting academy. But to visit him, they would need to go to Repulse Bay, which was an hour's drive away. Choi felt that something was up, but she needed this business contact if her academy was to survive. So she decided to trust her new friend. They arrived near the seaside in a taxi, only for Choi to be told that to reach this man's villa, they would need to take a 10-minute motorboat ride. Shui's gut instincts fully kicked in, and she realised that the last thing she wanted to do was to get into that boat. As she began to make excuses, the men in the motorboat jumped out, grabbed her, and they forced her into the boat, kicking and screaming. As the boat sped through the bay, one of the men calmly told her where they were going. They were going to North Korea to see the son of the dear leader.
Choi remembered being given an injection and waking up in a freighter. For 6 nightmarish days and nights, Choi endured the journey to Nampo Harbor. There, she disembarked and was met by Kim Jong-il, who had the audacity to tell her that she looked very nice.
Oh, God.
What a creep.
That says everything, doesn't it, really?
Yep. Two of his security staff took her by the arms and guided her to Jong-il's black Mercedes. Choi was not impressed by what she saw from the car window, describing the landscape that she saw as from a war zone. For 2 agonizing hours, she had to put up with Jong-il's attempts at small talk while she tried to control her rising panic until they finally reached Pyongyang. From there, Choi was taken to a luxury villa complete with home cinema and housekeeping staff, and she was given a personal keeper called Kim Huk-sun. Jong-il then took her passport. The villa, or building number 1, as it was also called, might have been a luxury prison, but it was still a prison. And Choi had no idea why she was there. She had no way of contacting her family or friends, And she didn't even know if she would ever be allowed back into South Korea. She was provided with fresh flowers every day, had her own doctor, designer clothes, and gourmet food. She was ordered to attend Jong-il's strange dinner parties, where she was expected to socialize with the very men who had been involved in her kidnapping.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. The parties were attended by the party members, and the girls of the Joy Brigade, who were there to entertain and provide services to the men. There was gambling, music and drinking, and even the occasional strip show on Jong-il's command. Anyone who told the dear leader about his son's parties were apparently shot in the middle of the celebrations, although Choi thankfully never witnessed any of these executions herself. These weekly parties were painful for Choi, who had to sit next to Jong-il and put up with his boorish, cruel humour and his loud demands. She spent the years from 1978 to 1983 being moved from the villa to other residences and back again, being told she had to socialise with Jong-il and, most tedious of all, embark on a re-education program with a private tutor. By that, I of course mean brainwashing.
Mm-hmm.
She was instructed to write numerous letters to Kim Jong-il, thanking him for giving her the opportunity to live a better life. During these years, she suffered terribly from depression and the frustration of never getting a straight answer about why she was there at all. Jong-il would tease her with references to Shin Sang-ok, and during one party, she was told that that evening would be the happiest of her life. It was at this party in March of 1983 that Choi saw someone new enter the room, a man who was gaunt, covered in sores, and who had sad, haunted eyes. It was her ex-husband, Shin Sang-ok.
Oh, dear. So, what was Shin Sang-ok doing there, and what had he been doing for the past 5 years, you might ask? Well, to answer that, we have to go back to 1978. Shin was concerned about Shuai. Remember that they had shared custody of adopted children and ran an acting academy together. So even though they weren't divorced, they were still in frequent contact. Shui hadn't returned from Hong Kong, and Shin felt that something was up. His Shin production staff in Hong Kong told him that she had last been seen with Mrs. Lee, and this made him very uneasy. Mrs. Lee had long been suspected of having pro-North Korea sentiments. This wasn't the only thing on Shin's mind. Since he wasn't permitted to make films in his own country anymore, he felt he had no choice but to go to Los Angeles and hustle his way around Hollywood and then try his luck in Hong Kong. It was around this time that Shui's disappearance hit the newsstands in South Korea, and the number one suspect was Shin himself. Indeed, as soon as he arrived in Hong Kong, he was detained by detectives and questioned about his ex-wife. Shin was in a desperate situation. He needed to stay in Hong Kong, both to find Shuai and to have at least one film greenlit so he could obtain a resident visa. One of his staffers had a solution. He knew a man who could get him a passport for $10,000. And where did he have to go to meet this very helpful man, you may ask? You guessed it, Repulse Bay. You can probably predict what happened next. It was very similar to the kidnapping of Shuai, and Shin found himself in a cargo ship on the same journey his ex had been forced to take 6 months previously.
Like Choi, Shin was taken to a villa that was full of every comfort, including clothing in his exact size. Unlike Choi, though, he wasn't given an audience with Jong-il and was only able to catch glimpses of him during the festivals and events that he was taken to by his minders. He was tutored in the ways of the glorious leader, Kim Il-sung and made to memorize passages of his biography. He was also forced to watch hours of North Korean movies, which he found absolutely agonizing. He was determined to get out. On his first escape attempt, Shin slipped out of the surprisingly unlocked house and made his way to the car, which still had the keys in the ignition. His plan was to drive to Cheongju and then find a way to cross the river to China. It was a wild ride full of events and misadventures, and this event could take up a whole podcast of its own. But he was asleep on the top of a freight train when the state police spotted him. He was arrested and dumped into a prison camp. North Korean internment camps are absolutely no joke, but I won't go into the horrors they contain, as it is pure nightmare fuel. I'll just say that Shin was put into solitary confinement, given only enough food to keep him alive. After 15 days, he was questioned about his love and devotion to the dear leader, and he must have given correct enough answers, as he was then given a vitamin supplement every day. Well, that's nice. After 3 months of excruciating hunger, isolation, and hideous boredom, Shin was allowed to shower and get dressed, and he was given a haircut. He was taken to a different house from the one he'd lived in previously, and he was ordered to write a groveling letter of apology to Kim Jong-il for all the trouble he had caused. After this, Shin did his best to look like the perfect student of ideological studies, all the while planning his next escape. One day, he noticed a panel in the wall of the upstairs guest room could be moved to reveal a sizable crawl space. He stuffed his pockets with food scraps and matches, any small objects that could be useful when staying hidden, crawled into the wall and slid the panel behind him. His plan was to wait until his absence was noticed and everyone in the household left to search for him, then to leave the empty house and somehow get somewhere else. He hadn't really planned that far ahead. The plan backfired because, unfortunately, they set up search headquarters inside the house. So he was stuck in the wall for 3 days until a cleaner noticed that a panel in the wall wasn't quite right and they found him.
He was taken to prison number 6, otherwise known as the Enlightenment Center, a place even more hellish than the internment camp. Tortured, starved, and beaten for almost 4 years, Shin survived by directing films in his imagination. During this time, he asked if he could write to Kim Jong-il, and surprisingly, he was granted permission. He wrote copious letters to the leader's son, promising him that if he were set free, then he would give his talents to North Korea and make movies for them. He wrote pages of analysis on all the movies he had watched while kept under house arrest, and gave advice about what he would have done to make them even better. There is so much that we could go into here, including a failed hunger strike, but it's one of those times where there's just too much information. In 1983, Shin was allowed to wash himself for the first time in years, then was let out of the prison and into Mercedes. 10 days later, he was at Kim Jong-il's party, standing face to face with his ex-wife.
They were barely able to speak to each other before Jong-il ordered them to hug each other and joked that they should get back together.
Oh my God. An absolutely hilarious guy. Not someone you want to punch at all, is he?
Well, the thing is, it may have been the only good thing he ever did. He made them live as a couple in the villa that he'd given Chui to live in when they'd first arrived. And they did almost immediately fall back in love with each other.
Yeah, but they, like, yes, but that's not necessarily a good thing, though. I don't think, you know, proximity doesn't make for the best of reasons for a relationship.
It is a bit of a trauma bond, isn't it?
It's just a little bit of a trauma bond. Just a little bit. Oh, dear. Okay. So, look, it could be said that they'd never fallen out of love, though. This is where things can get really psychologically confusing. Both Shuai and Shin had been through utter hell at the whims of Kim Jong-il. They'd been taken away from their children, made to live in terror, and in Shin's case, horrendous torture. But they'd also been given jobs as leaders of the North Korean film industry, which on some level, they actually kind of enjoyed. Shin also liked discussing films with Jong-il. Was it a kind of Stockholm syndrome, or were they so intent on survival they forced themselves into a performance so convincing that they almost convinced themselves? Well, whatever it was, it did not stop Shin from purchasing a tiny recording device with the intention of recording everything that Jong-il said. Shuai carried the device in her handbag during the couple's first formal business meeting with Jong-il. Secretly recording his voice was an offence punishable by death, but they decided it was worth the risk. They were told that their long imprisonments were just simply a misunderstanding and not his fault at all.
Could you imagine Jong-il doing a YouTuber apology?
With a ukulele?
Yeah. Yes. And could you imagine the passive aggressiveness? Yes, you were tortured for several years in prison, but it was all a misunderstanding. It wasn't actually my fault.
Not his fault at all. So Jong-il then confirmed what Shin had long suspected, that they were brought to North Korea to upgrade the local film industry. He admitted that directors and actors in the South had superior skills, and he needed them to bring fresh ideas and techniques to the production set. Shin and Shuai would be given total creative control and unlimited budgets, things that Shin had constantly been denied in his own country. The catch? They had to publicly announce they had not been kidnapped, but had actually defected of their own free will. Now, I have a theory here.
Uh-huh.
I don't believe that. I don't believe. Somehow I think Shin's making that up. I'm sorry, but I do. Because I can't see the dear leader's son ever admitting ever that their own production staff weren't as good as South Korea.
No, it happened because they've recorded him.
Really?
He's on their audio cassette tapes.
No.
Admitting that.
I want to hear these tapes.
Oh, well, they're there. Well, you have to be able to
understand Korean.
But they are on YouTube and with subtitles.
What? Oh, my God.
Yeah, it happens.
I feel like I've entered some bizarre parallel universe in this story.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it kind of goes to show just how much Jong-il really loved movies. He loved them to the point where he was willing to put his ego aside to have a good film industry.
So do you think, I mean, probably we should be talking about this at the end of the podcast, but do you think he had kidnapped him in the beginning to do the movies? And if so, why?
Yes.
Why so long before he got them doing it?
Because Shin kept escaping. And he had to punish
him. He hadn't been re-educated.
He had to punish him and make sure that he was re-educated to the point where he could be trusted.
My goodness. We play a long game, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, so sorry, everybody. Let's get back to the podcast.
So Shin and Shuai set to work untangling the many problems and inefficiencies within the North Korean studio system. And there were a lot. They were even allowed to travel to and film in other countries on their side of the Iron Curtain, albeit surrounded by minders who brought their chances of escape down to zero. Their first film, The Emissary of No Return, was a roaring success, in the opinion of Kim Jong-il anyway, and his opinion was the only opinion that really mattered. Making movies was easy. It was the press conference that was difficult. Shin had to sit in a hotel room in Belgrade and tell reporters what he knew the leader wanted him to say. He began with, "My wife and I were absolutely not kidnapped."
Which sounds like something a kidnapped person would say.
It totally does. Shin told the reporters that he was disgusted by the censorship laws of the South and offended that President Park had withdrawn his friendship and support, and that he and Choi Yun-hee were now happily making movies for the Dear Leader. That had to have hurt. However, A Misery of No Return taking out a Best Director award in a Czech film festival must have been some balm for the wounds.
It really is complicated. He couldn't make films in his own country, and here he's given the opportunity to rebuild his career and do what he loves most in the world. But he's also away from his family, and he would have known he would have been considered a total disgrace and that his kids would be ashamed.
There was also the damage that was done to those kids. They felt that they'd been publicly abandoned and left with the consequences of having traitor parents, both the adopted kids and the kids Shin had with his new partner. The damage went very, very deep. And I was reading that the adopted kids actually hadn't been told that they were adopted. They found out via the media at this time. So they were really damaged.
Yeah, you think?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, anyway, the couple did achieve the goal that Jong-il had in mind when he'd had them kidnapped, though. They brought North Korean cinema to life, and for the first time, people were queuing up to the cinema in droves. It wasn't just the improvements to the technical side of filmmaking that had them back. It was that the characters were now psychologically realistic and relatable, and the stories were actually engaging. Also pulling people in was a depiction of romance on the big screen, which was something very new to them. There was even kissing. I know! Shuai started off as assistant director and acting coach, but she eventually returned to acting herself and became as much of a celebrity as she had been in the South. The most known Shin film of this time is 1985's Pulgasari, an epic monster film in the style of Godzilla.
So I personally found Pulgasari unwatchable. A lot of people like it in a so bad it's good way, and I can't even do that. And as you know, I absolutely love so bad it's good movies.
Yeah. There's one, was it The Room that you...
The Room.
Oh, look, shut up about. No, I don't want to hear about it.
It was also Neil Breen. Neil Breen's movies I can't shut up about. Okay. Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. Change subject. Back to Godzilla.
Yeah. So if you look at Pulgasari compared to, say, another movie released that year, say Back to the Future, It's unbelievable that they're in the same time frame. Now, I'm not saying that Hollywood is the be-all and end-all, and North Korea would have had a comparably much smaller budget. But my reaction was that Shin was too good of a filmmaker to think that Pulgasari was a great movie. But he really did. And Jong-il absolutely adored it.
Of course he did. Anyway, Shin and Shuai were still planning their escape. There were things that they loved about their lives as filmmakers for North Korea, but the reality was that they were political prisoners under the rule of a cruel despot and his son, a man who could take away his adoration and have them executed at any moment. In 1986, they saw their chance when they were permitted to go to the Berlin Film Festival, followed by a trip to Vienna to set up a European branch of their production company, something Jong-il dearly wanted. In Vienna, they had set up an interview with a Japanese journalist called Akira Enoki. Shin and Shuai boasted loudly of their plans to do some amazing PR work for the great leader. They were going to make it clear once and for all that they loved North Korea and were definitely not being forced to stay there against their will. The problem, they said, was that the Japanese journalists would look with suspicion upon their minders. The minders agreed to a compromise. They wouldn't actually go with them into the restaurant so as not to cramp their style, but they would be directly outside watching the door at all times. When Inoki's taxi arrived, the minders were far enough away that Shin and Shuei could jump into the taxi, close the doors, and yell at the driver to hit the pedal. What then ensued was a car chase that could have belonged to any action movie. But we will cut to the chase and say that the taxi driver did manage to evade the minders, did make it to the US embassy, and Shin and Shuei were able to run the 50 yards from where the taxi was permitted to park to the embassy door. They had finally escaped.
The US embassy granted them asylum, and in return they told the CIA everything they knew about Kim Jong-il and North Korea, which was quite a lot. And remember, they had audio recordings of him. They were provided with a house in Reston, Virginia, and they were even reunited with their children. This must have been bittersweet, as they were no longer children. The daughter had recently gotten married, and the son was understandably distant and cautious around them. Shin's children from his second family were flown over to live with them permanently, and Shuei joyfully took on the role of doting stepmother. Shin and Shuei took US citizenship and then remarried. They moved to California, and Shin tried desperately to pitch his ideas to production companies. His reputation as one of the biggest directors in Korean film history meant very little to them, and the few opportunities that he was offered flopped badly. Shuei did not even try to resurrect her own career. She knew that she was not what Hollywood wanted in an actress. What they both really wanted, they realized, was to go home.
Aww.
On their return to South Korea, they were interrogated harshly by the South Korean CIA, but ultimately released into a country they didn't recognize anymore. The public was skeptical of their story, and they were widely regarded as traitors. They lived a humble lifestyle in a tiny house in Seoul until Shin died in 2006. Once a vivacious, loud, energetic man, he spent his last years as a quiet, reclusive invalid. Shuei died of kidney complications in 2018 at the age of 91. So, what happened to Kim Jong-il after his besties defected? All we know is that he took Shin's names off the credits of Paul Gasari. Now, at first I thought this was kind of funny, like, oh, yeah, who cares? But it actually did hit Shin very hard because Paul Gasari was released on VHS to the US market, and somebody who, like me, who loves So Bad It's Good, discovered it, and it became this huge cult classic. And because Shin was not credited, he couldn't receive royalties.
Oh my
God. So, yeah, it ended up being a problem. And we all know what happened during his terrible reign after the death of his father. Now, remember, he was the guy eating imported lobster and French wine while his people were crawling around in the grass looking for garden weeds to eat.
Not a great guy.
Oh, no, he wasn't. He wasn't great. And his son isn't that great either, is he?
No.
No. Kim Jong-un, not so good. Although he's not that into films.
Thank goodness.
Kim Jong-un, no, he likes TV. He's apparently funneled a lot of resources into the TV industry.
And basketball.
Basketball, yeah. And just being a creep in general, yeah.
See, there's so much of this story you can see why some people didn't believe that they weren't kidnapped and stuff like that. But every aspect of what happened to them is so bizarre that you can't actually place a common sense outcome. Something. So, for example,
yeah,
the whole being upset that he wasn't credited with Pulgasari. For me, I would imagine in my own, you know, privileged way that if I had been treated so badly by a country and by a leader, I would be delighted to no longer be associated with something that was so intrinsically attached to propaganda. And does that make sense to you?
I think that Shin was just so obsessed with being a director. I think that any film that he made was kind of just a part of him and something that he needed to be proud of.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I'll tell you what, that's got to be the biggest get back together story I've ever heard in my life.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Was it ever? And I tell you what, it was such a difficult story to research because there were so many sources. So I had this excellent book by Paul Fisher. There are so many documentaries. There are so many interviews with the people at the heart of the story, and which is a wonderful thing, but the story is just so big you could devote an entire 10-part podcast
series to it. Absolutely. I think we need to link the Apple movie on our Facebook page, see if other people get so enchanted by it as we did.
That was weird how we just fell under the spell of that Apple movie.
Was it weird, Heidi? Or is that what it's designed to
Was it Comrade?
Yeah, we've got to watch out for each other here.
Yeah, we do.
If we'd watched any, many more, what would have happened to us? Who knows?
Oh, who knows?
Who knows? Anyway, comrades, the time has come.
Farewell, comrades, and sleep tight, and leave us some stars on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. We'd really, really love that.
Yes, show your adoration to us.
Yeah, and we'll see you later.
Okay, see ya. Bye.
Bye.